Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point. America alone at the G7 summit. Canada's Justin Trudeau leads the pushback.
The idea that we are somehow a national security threat to the United States is quite frankly insulting and unacceptable.
Pardon me? President Trump says he can do that. House Speaker Paul Ryan warns not so fast.
I don't know the technical answer to that question, but I think obviously the answer is he shouldn't, and no one is above the law.
And another high-profile suicide. Chef and food writer Anthony Bourdain.
We have some terribly sad news to report this morning. Heartbreaking and devastating. World-renowned chef, best-selling author, award-winning host of Parts Unknown, and our friend, Anthony Bourdain, has died.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with John Harwood, Janet Hook, and On Point, Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Is America alone at the G7 summit? Will President Trump's attitude be enough to carry him in the North Korea summit? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, joining me from Washington is John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC. John, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Robert.
And also in Washington, Janet Hook, national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Janet, great to have you back with us.
Great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Robert, John, and Janet. Just a note. Last week, I referred to, quote, the cult-like core of Trump supporters. Clay Robinson, one of our listeners, objected that that was a slur. In the week that Justice Kennedy reminded us of the necessity of tolerant speech, I apologize for that. I should have said devoted adherence or something like that.
You're retracting the word cult in that.
I am in indeed.
Okay. On to Donald Trump and the G7, the U.S. and the G7. Even as he had exchanged criticisms with the leaders of Canada and France over trade policies, before he got onto Marine One this morning, President Trump told reporters something else about the G7. Russia should be readmitted.
Whether you like it or not, and it may not be politically correct, but we have a world to run. And in the G7, which used to be the G8, they threw Russia out. They should let Russia come back in, because we should have Russia at the negotiating table.
John Harwood, what do you make of that?
I think it's amazing. And when he says politically correct, it's not politically correct. It's not politically correct for him at a time when he's under a serious investigation and his campaign is under a serious investigation involving interactions with Russia. The idea that he would head off to a summit of our allies, openly fighting with allies and extending a hand to Russia is beyond strange. And it, when you take it on its face, it makes you wonder whether or not, in fact, the president has some sort of obligation, commitment, alliance with Russia that is way, way out of the ordinary.
You know, Janet Hook, one thing that struck me is that given the fact that President Trump knows that there's much controversy surrounding his alleged relationship with Russia, he sure doesn't mind bringing on the criticism of that. He didn't seem shy about this.
That's for sure. I thought that was just the most Trumpy moment, that the idea that he would do something so kind of politically heedless and reckless almost to bring that up. It's like he's calling for the return of the G8 at a time when everyone else is thinking of it as the G6 plus one, because he has done so much to isolate the United States. This is really sort of setting a tone. He was already heading into a really rocky summit, and this has really got to make it rockier.
And I should add here, by the way, that the G7 is not a group of the seven biggest economies in the world. If it were, China would be part of it, which it isn't. It's historically seven industrialized democracies. So that's that last word, democracies, Jack Beatty, seems to be what's at question regarding Russia's participation in this group.
Yes, and I quite agree with John and Janet. That was an extraordinary and perhaps revealing statement. But, you know, this comes at a moment. The president represents a country that is, according to Nick Burns, in a startling comment the other day, former State Department official, he said the United States is more alone in the world than at any time since the Senate turned down the League of Nations in 1919. That is just an amazing moment for the United States. And it isn't as if the strategy the president is pursuing on trade, I, of course, allude to these tariffs, it isn't as if the goal may be dubious. Can you really achieve anything in the world with tariffs? But the strategy he's pursuing seems to be, as Larry Summers observed, to, you know, really divide your friends and unite your enemies. He needs to unite the friends against China, which is the serious impediment in our trade. Yeah. Instead, with these tariffs, he's dividing our friends.
And Robert, the point that Jack was just making is related to Russia itself. That is to say, he, by extending a hand to bring Russia in, that's one thing. But it's also a core objective of Vladimir Putin to divide the Western alliance. Mm-hmm. And so the tariff battles, the war of words, the openly calling out leaders of the Western alliance raises the question again of he is appears to be doing Putin's bidding. There's no other way to describe it.
Well, he has another big summit on his calendar. That's the one coming up in Singapore with North Korea. At the White House with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Thursday, Trump was asked by a reporter how he was preparing for the North Korea summit, and this was his answer.
I think I'm very well prepared. I don't think I have to prepare very much. It's about attitude. It's about willingness to get things done.
This, Janet Hook, I mean, this does raise a question because Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, when he was asked about this, said the president is being prepared. He's spending a lot of time getting ready for the summit. But again, there's a question of, what did you say, the other was a Trumpy moment? Another one. I'm going with my gut. It's how I feel about things that'll run this summit. You concerned at all about this?
Yeah, I mean, it really looks like he's going into this negotiation with North Korea as if it were a real estate deal in New York. You know, all swagger, all attitude, all gut, all intuition. And if there's one country in the world that we have no intuition about, it's North Korea. Everybody else approaches that country with tremendous caution. And
you mean it's so opaque that we just don't know enough
about
it?
Yes, there's a huge sense of mystery about what they're aiming for. So That was not a very reassuring introduction to his state of mind heading to North Korea.
Jack Beatty, do you believe it? I mean, do you think he's really not getting prepared for the North Korea summit in the way that a president might?
Well, Secretary of State Pompeo says he is being prepared. That there are, and the White House issued some statement about a booklet that he looks at every night. So perhaps that was swagger. But you know, one aspect of this is worth noting, and this is raised by Nick Kristof in the Times yesterday. The Democrats, led by Chuck Schumer and others, have sent a letter, sort of putting this summit in the shade and saying, basically demanding things of North Korea that John Bolton would demand, pretty much disarmament now, to oversimplify. And this is, talk about partisanship. They can't even say, well, we're hopeful for this summit. We want something to come out of it. Instead, there's this maximalism that they're coming out with that reminds us that in the late campaign, it was Trump who was the more dovish candidate.
You know, I just wanted to go back to something, Jack, that you said and put it to the others about the remark that the U.S. is more, was it more isolated from the rest of the world than any time since 1918? That was after a fairly long, frustrating war, the First World War, which Americans had taken part in. We're now still in a very frustrating conflict in the world. I wonder, John Harwood, you do a lot of political reporting. Does it play well with people to say, after all of these years, after these wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, yeah, let's get out of this world?
In some ways it does. Americans are not eager for more American adventurism overseas. The Iraq War hangover is still there. The war in Afghanistan has still been going on. But I do think that there is a sense, certainly not a universal sense, but among people in the center of the electorate, that you need a sober, balanced, modern approach to the world. And I don't think President Trump is inspiring confidence that he is taking such an approach. And, you know, remember, he's got an approval rating in the Wall Street Journal NBC poll that we published this week of 44%. That is up a bit from where he'd been before. The economy's doing very well, but it's quite low in absolute terms. So he has a base that he appeals to, and people like the pullback, but I think they want a level of maturity in their leadership.
I think we should probably note about the forthcoming North Korea summit that President Trump has downgraded our expectations, or his public expectations of what's going to happen. Jack Beatty, now he's talking about developing a process of diplomacy with North Korea. It's not I'm going there to get him to completely disarm overnight.
Yes, and it's a good thing he did that, because if he had gone with the sort of John Bolton line of a couple of weeks ago, it would have resulted in a diplomatic disaster. So yes, he's. He is showing himself, contra John there, sober. it seems to me he's lowering expectations to the pitch of reality.
We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the president's self-pardon claim after this week's primaries? How are you reading the midterm tea leaves? I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're diving into the week's top stories. You can join our conversation. What's your take on President Trump's pardons? Can Congress pass an immigration plan? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC, Janet Hook, national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. We learned of the letter that Donald Trump's lawyers had sent to the special counsel, which, among other things, spelt out the White House's view, or at least President Trump's lawyers' view, of presidential powers. Those include the power to pardon himself, and they also included the idea that the president can't be held for obstruction of justice, because he is justice. He can't obstruct himself. Janet Hook, let's start with you. What was the takeaway from that statement by the Trump legal team?
Well, it was a pretty bold statement. It was a kind of through the looking glass in a way. But it has put Republicans who've been trying to stand with President Trump, put Republicans in a very awkward position. It was actually sort of hilarious. On the Hill, reporters were trying to get Republicans to comment on whether they thought the president could pardon himself, and it was very awkward. Finally, Speaker Ryan spoke for many, I think, when he said, well, I don't know about the legality of it, but it really would be a bad idea for him to, warning against him exercising that pardon power. I didn't hear anybody kind of stepping forward and agreeing with him on it. Yeah. And this notion that he couldn't possibly obstruct justice because, as you put it, he is justice. I mean, that is really, I don't think many people agree with that on a legal basis, let alone a political one.
Jack Beattie, what did you think about that letter?
Well, it reminded me of the, you know, the Watergate era, and particularly of a book by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., The Imperial Presidency. And this was the imperial presidency in spades. I mean, the president's tweet, the absolute right to pardon myself. Chilling that he seems to view the law as no impediment to anything he wants to do. I was, though, encouraged by the signs of, you know, moral respiration among some Republicans. There were people in the Senate, too, who criticized these sweeping claims. And along with the criticisms of his trade policy, there does seem to be some more Republican resistance to pick up on Janet's term, the Trumpier moments here of Trump.
I'm going to turn to a listener now. Robert is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Robert, you were struck by the president's claim that he can pardon himself?
Yes, I am. It kind of reminds me of the old story about hearing noises in the middle of the night from downstairs, and you hear a voice saying, don't worry about a thing, I'm not stealing anything. I mean, from a legal standpoint, there's nothing that can be proven, but from a political standpoint, it just raises a lot of red flags about him feeling guilty about being engaged in activities that wouldn't be accepted by the American populace.
I wonder, John Harwood, could the president prosecute himself?
Yeah, I suppose he could. He could prosecute himself for being too good a negotiator. But look, I agree with the caller. In fact, I think what the letter betrayed was a sense from President Trump and his team that the Mueller investigation is drawing closer and closer, and that the president is willing to push the boundaries of possibility of a response. You know, we've discussed for some time in the past, recent past, that the idea that a sitting president cannot be indicted, and that's based on a Justice Department opinion, never tested in court, but an opinion that he cannot be.
Right. It's a there policy, was a not a judicial ruling.
Correct. There was a similar policy that came under discussion when President Nixon was in trouble over Watergate, and that paper said, no, the president could not pardon himself. So this is something that he's not going to be bound by anything short of a Supreme Court ruling, if that.
Something else happened this week. Tuesday was primary day in a few states, among them California. And the Democratic candidate for governor, as the result of that primary, Gavin Newsom, celebrated with voters after his victory in the California primary.
This is only the first half of the election calendar, but thanks to you, the halftime score is looking very promising, and the home team is winning big.
Janet Hook, did the primaries this week prove anything other than that the conventional wisdom remains conventionally wise? Democrats look pretty strong for November.
Yes. There was a certain amount of suspense going into the California primaries, though, because it looked like in the congressional primaries that the Democrats might be victims of their own success. California has this odd primary system where candidates from both parties run on one ticket and the top two candidates advance. it could be two Democrats or two Republicans. And they had these districts where there were so many candidates running as Democrats that there was a threat that they would spread the vote too thinly and only Republicans would advance. That did not happen. There was a lot of concern about it. Democratic Party officials took a lot of efforts to and spent a lot of money to advance their candidates. So overall, it was a very good day for congressional Democrats, but it was mostly about them not squandering opportunities.
On the other hand, the Republicans were not totally knocked out of statewide races in California, which seemed at some point to have been a possibility that they would cease to be a statewide party there.
That's right. There was some question of whether the Republicans would be locked out of the governor's race, because it had long been expected that Gavin Newsom would place in first place. The question was whether another Democrat, former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, would get the second slot. But as it happened, it was a Republican businessman, John Cox, who got there, I think, largely on the strength of the party establishment, worrying about just that, that they wouldn't have a candidate at the top of the ticket. And he did manage to get in over Villaraigosa.
And Robert, to your point about not changing the fundamental picture of Democrats on track for a good result in November, there's been some backing and forthing on that subject over the last few months. Democrats did well in special elections, but President Trump's approval rating has been rising, and people wonder whether that was going to lift his party. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll that Janet and I both report on came out yesterday and showed Democrats with a 10 percentage point lead in the so-called generic ballot. That suggests that they're in quite a strong position, and that result was affirmed by a subsequent poll by Fox News that came out later yesterday.
I saw those numbers.
On the third hand, if I might, 538, the Nate Silber blog, they calculated that if you just judge by the economy, the GOP would gain 55 seats. So a red tide if you just look at the economy.
But you don't. I was curious, John Harwood, or Jenna for that matter, does the poll suggests that the favorability of Donald Trump and of the Republican Party are not going in the same direction right now. Is that – am I reading the numbers right?
Yeah, actually, our new poll showed Trump's approval rating had bounced up some. But the thing about Trump's approval rating, it does seem to go on its own – operate by its own gravity, because our poll showed his approval rating going up as the Democrats' generic advantage went in the other direction. But it has been kind of within a narrow range throughout his presidency. This is on the higher end. I do think that, to be honest with you, after 2016, when people ask me what I think the outcome of the midterm elections is, I think the wisest answer is who knows.
Who knows? Okay. There's another big issue this week. And in fact, Alex, our listener, is calling from Barnstable, Massachusetts about it. It's immigration. There's a move toward having a vote on an immigration bill in the House. Alex, what do you think about the discussion of immigration this week?
Hi, Robert. I just had a question for the panel. I feel like Trump and Republicans have put forward a pretty clear vision on how they want to change the immigration system and deal with current undocumented immigrants, but we haven't really been given a clear, coherent alternative by Democrats. And, like, does that mean that they're okay with the current system, or is it a strategy not to get pinned down by one specific vision?
Good question. What is the Democratic Party's position on immigration? Either of you Washingtonians can take it. Janet, what would you say?
Well, they have been very strong on wanting the DACA program to be made permanent. That's one thing. And I think for a long time it's been clear that Democrats' highest priorities have been involving resolving the problem of the 11 million people who are here illegally by offering some kind of pathway to citizenship. Mm-hmm. I think right now their battle is so focused on DACA because it's the – and that's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that – has, under Obama, gave protected status to some people who had come as children with their parents illegally. The point is that has been under such an immediate threat by the Trump administration that's been the principal focus of Democrats in the last several months.
And the latest news there is that the Justice Department has said that in the challenge to the constitutionality of DACA, at least some of its provisions, the federal government, the Justice Department, will not defend it. So they, so far as they're concerned, would prefer its defeat, obviously. Jack Beatty, thoughts on immigration and the state of the debate?
Well, the GOP moderates who are who've been organizing this discharge petition, essentially an effort to force a vote on immigration measures in the House by partnering with Democrats. They say Tuesday it is the moment that the Speaker will either decide on a Republican position amenable to them on the one hand and the conservatives on the other and vote on that, or they will go ahead. They have the votes, they say, to have their discharge petition, and there will be a vote on their program, which is DACA plus some unclear exactly what the other elements are going to be.
But I want to ask John Harwood about that. Is that, do you think that that drama about the discharge petition and a vote in the House, even though Senator McConnell doesn't seem likely to bring anything to the Senate, is that to actually legislate, or is that to give a number of Republican congressmen the opportunity as they run for re-election to say, I voted for to protect DACA and in favor of immigration?
A little bit of the former and mostly the latter. You've got Republican members of Congress who have significant Latino populations in their district who, being lashed to Trump and the maximalist border control position that he has, is a huge liability for them. So Carlos Curbelo, who is in Congress from South Florida, is doing everything he can to demonstrate that he is pushing back against this policy. I'm quite skeptical that a DACA fix is going to end up getting legislated. But even if the part of the motivation is political, electoral, you can't fault members for pushing forward a solution that they think is in the best interest of their district, and we'll see what happens.
You give it a chance? I mean, do you think it's possible?
Very small.
Very small.
Very small.
Janet?
I do think that the politics of it are just really vivid, because what you have is a situation in the House where the moderate wing of the party is saying, if we don't pass a bill to help the DACA people, our majority is at risk. We will lose and our majority is at risk. Whereas the conservatives say, if we vote for something like that, our base will get infuriated and our majority is at risk. So this is an issue that threatens them politically in many ways.
Earlier, we were talking about the president claiming a pardon authority, or his lawyer saying he could pardon himself. And there have been some pardons, including a pardon of the late boxer Jack Johnson, I mean, long time ago, late boxer Jack Johnson. There were stories today, I should tell you all, about a possible pardon for Muhammad Ali. And the NAACP Legal Defense Fund has alerted everyone through a tweet that Muhammad Ali doesn't need a pardon because his conviction had already been reversed and all charges were dropped. His legal battle ended in 1971 when the Supreme Court ruled in his favor. So a little bit of news on the pardon front. Back to politics and the outlook for November. Do you think? Well, let's start with you, Jack. I mean, do you think that this is going to be an election about Donald Trump? You mentioned that there's news that if it were only about the economy, Republicans win. Mitt Romney has said that he thinks Donald Trump can not only get reelected, but renominated, but reelected because the economy is doing so well. What's the vote going to be about?
Well, I think the Democrats are disclaiming any intention to impeach the president. They recognize that that'll have a counterproductive effect, that it'll stir up the GOP base as much as it does their own base. On the other hand, I do think that is what the election is about, implicitly. That is, if there is a Democratic Congress, and if, as seems more and more likely, the Mueller investigation turns up things, either obstruction of justice or collusion, that warrant impeachment, or that might warrant impeachment, that's what's going to happen. The president, the Democrats in the House are going to work on that and be activated for it by their base. And they're going to say, no, we're not. That's not what we want. We just want to. But that's what the election, I think, really is going to be about.
I wanted to raise one question for our Washington journalist, which is there was the announcement last night that a Senate Intelligence Committee staffer, former Senate Intelligence Committee staffer, is being accused of lying about leaking information. It involved, the investigation involved looking at a reporter's phone records and communications. Is the relationship between the press and the Trump administration getting more serious than just nasty verbal exchanges? What do you folks think? John, you want to take that? No, Janet,
well,
please.
I guess what I would say is don't know yet precisely what the leak in question that they were tracking down.
Right.
President Obama and his administration, on some leaks that they thought were important to national security, pushed the boundaries in ways that the press felt was a significant encroachment.
Yeah, they went after James Risen of the New York Times.
Correct. In this situation, it's a messy fact pattern because you have a reporter who was involved in a romantic relationship with a staff member, and her phone and communications records ended up getting seized. But again, don't know the underlying story that we're talking about.
We're just at the beginning of that. We're discussing the week in the news, and you can join the conversation. Was it the right call for President Trump to disinvite the Super Bowl champions to the White House? What do you make of former President Bill Clinton's remarks on Me Too and Monica Lewinsky? I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel. In other news this week, the 50th anniversary of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination.
What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion.
Sex and the City turns 20. In 1998, we first heard Carrie Bradshaw.
Welcome to the age of uninnocence. No one has breakfast at Tiffany's, and no one has affairs to remember. Instead, we have breakfast at 7 a.m. and affairs we try to forget as quickly as possible.
And very importantly, the Washington Capitals are Stanley Cup champions for the first time in their 44-year history.
The Capitals have won it! The capital of the country is the capital of the hockey playoffs! They rush out onto the ice to congratulate Braden Holtby!
You can join our conversation. Was it a slap in the face for President Trump to disinvite the Philadelphia Eagles to the White House? How are you remembering Robert Kennedy? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC, Janet Hook, national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, let's start with the strange reappearance of Bill Clinton this week, now as the author or co-author of a thriller, and being asked, perhaps not surprisingly, about the Me Too movement and Monica Lewinsky. How would you describe his performance?
Well, it was self-pitying, and in that regard, as others have pointed out, very Trumpian. He said, listen, I didn't get out of this for free. I left the White House $16 million in debt. The Post fact-checker couldn't get anywhere near that $16 million in looking into it. And Forbes noted that in the 15 years after leaving the White House, the president made $189 million, which is, of course, implicit at the moment that he left the White House, that he was going to earn a lot of money. And he couldn't even, in that interview, step up to the level of what he had done. I mean, Monica Lewinsky, in her Vanity Fair article, took responsibility for this, but she also said, he was 27 years my senior with enough life experience to know better. I was in my first job out of college. So the interviewer asked Mr. Clinton, do you take more responsibility in the view of that comment and the Me Too movement? The president said, that was litigated 20 years ago. Two-thirds of the American people sided with me. Very, very strange performance.
Janet Cook, what was your sense of Mr. Clinton this week?
Well, he did come back and admit in a subsequent interview that it wasn't his finest hour. And the original interview, though, was it kind of reminded us of why Bill Clinton got into trouble in the first place. When the interviewer asked him, "Have you apologized to Monica Lewinsky?" his reaction was, I apologized, but he hadn't apologized to her. He was referring to the fact that he had kind of generically apologized. And that kind of verbal dodge reminded me of, you know, I didn't have sex with that woman.
It depends what the meaning of apologize is.
Right. Depends on the meaning of what is. Yeah, right.
John, did you have any reactions to the Clinton show?
I thought it was a very bad performance by the president. And I thought that what it betrayed was he has a consuming anger against the media, which he is unable to control when provoked in certain ways. And as he acknowledged the next day, what he really ought to be angry about is himself for making such a horrendous mistake morally, politically, and every other way. And my colleague Craig Melvin, who interviewed him, I thought did a superb professional job in questioning him.
A caller, Mary, is on the line from Hebron, Connecticut, has something to say about Bill Clinton. Hi, welcome to the program, Mary.
Hi, thank you, Robert. It's good to hear your voice. I'm just calling to say that I believe that Bill Clinton should rethink what he needs to say about what he did in light of the Me Too movement. It was my opinion that he should have resigned way back, simply because I think he abused his power. And I vote Democrat, and I think we would be in better shape now. Of course, it's hypothetical, but I think we'd be in better shape now if Al Gore had been able to take over back then. But that's really all I had to say.
Yeah, there is a whole counterfactual history of the 21st century one can compose if that were the case. I guess there is one common, at least one very important common theme. People, John Harwood, people don't like the idea of reversing the election. I mean, the impeachment, whatever people thought of Bill Clinton, wasn't a very popular event.
No, and, you know, you had a president who in many ways was successful. The economy recovered and boomed on his watch. He was very politically skillful, even while generating as Janet indicated his talent for getting himself in trouble, both in a political matter and double talk and the Lewinsky thing, among others. So, I do think there is an appropriate reluctance on the part of the American people to reverse election results. And in the case of Clinton, there was a feeling that you had a Republican Congress out for blood that was people weren't too happy with either. And as a result, in a very historically unusual result, Republicans lost ground in the 1998 midterm elections.
Well, now we go on to this peculiar ceremony that occurred at the White House this week, which was supposed to be, it was intended to be a celebration of the Super Bowl champs. Philadelphia Eagles coach Doug Peterson said on Wednesday his team, you know, ultimately was disinvited. Not very many of them intended to come, but he said he would have liked to visit the White House to celebrate the team's Super Bowl win.
We did something last season that was very special. It's a milestone here in the city of Philadelphia, our organization, and I was looking forward to going down and being recognized as world champions. And, it is what it is.
Instead, there was a military band, a celebration of American servicemen and women. And is there anything important? I mean, do we need these events at the White House, Jack Beatty, where the president welcomes the champions or the whoever it may be of whatever sport?
Well, suddenly they've become controversial in the Trump era. Although I think there were several people who didn't show up at some of the Obama celebrations as well. But, you know, it just signaled with the red, white, and blue behind the president and the martial music and so on. It just signaled that he's going to polarize this. It's not going to be about First Amendment protest or symbolic protest. It's going to be about patriotism. You're not a patriot. You're not with the country. He's even said maybe you shouldn't even be in the country if you're not willing to stand up. I won't quote Dr. Johnson on patriotism, but people should look it up and see if it applies.
It's the last refuge, yes. Janet Hook, thoughts on the Super Bowl celebration at the White House that wasn't?
Well, I was just very struck. Trump did make it all about him and all about the question of whether NFL players should kneel, should be allowed to kneel during the national anthem. I think actually there were a lot of players I saw that were quoted that that wasn't why they were reluctant to go. There were many reasons why people were reluctant to go. But, you know, Trump really loves that NFL kneeling for the anthem issue. It really revs up his base. I was actually at the Alabama rally back in September when he first brought up that issue, and the crowd just went wild. I think actually it was as much the reaction of the Alabama crowd that encouraged him to carry forward with that as a kind of a wedge issue. And here it is, many months later, he still goes back to it at every opportunity.
And I mean, how have the Democrats responded to this, John Harwood? I mean, are they do they take the side of the players? Are they in favor of people not going to the White House? What is it a partisan political issue in Washington?
Well, I wouldn't say it's partisan, but it's pretty racial. And remember, the president has created this conflict. And is relishes this conflict in the belief that it helps him with his base. His base is white working class voters, especially people who feel a level of racial resentment. All the studies of his constituency after the 2016 found that support for Trump was positively associated with racial resentment on behalf of whites. So African Americans are an overwhelming Democratic constituency, yeah. And he's looking to President Trump at a time when he's not popular, is looking to motivate the people who have stuck with him by driving this argument. And Democrats don't have to do a whole lot, but it's pretty clear where this fight comes from.
Jack Beatty, is it a fight that Donald Trump is winning, regardless of what you or I might think of it?
Well, polls of Republican voters show strong supermajority support for his stand on kneeling and the national anthem. And so in that regard, it is succeeding. And he added a little of that in this impromptu press conference this morning. He said, you know, the players on these teams, they can suggest to me perhaps friends of theirs who were wrongly charged or in prison, and I'll consider pardoning them. Well, that sounds generous, but there was also the stereotype in there of, well, black athletes must know people who are in jail. Well,
But there is the problem that when one asks who is most feared, perhaps irrationally, the description is often a large, young, black man, and that describes two-thirds of the professional football players. It's these are guys who would naturally have experienced things like this or perhaps know people who've experienced unfortunate encounters with police officers. We are talking, by the way, about the week's news. John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC, we know that you have to leave us right now, so thanks so much for taking part.
My pleasure.
There was, this being 50 years after 1968, there is no end of 50th anniversaries of great and awful things that happened in the year 1968. One of them that we marked this week was the 50th anniversary of the death of Robert Kennedy. In fact, it's something that one of our callers, Edith, in Canton, Connecticut, has called to mention. Edith, what are your thoughts on RFK 50 years later?
Hi, Robert. We remember Robert Kennedy as a man for all people. I feel that is lacking so much today in our leadership of this country.
His outreach to and the warm reception he received from so many different kinds of people, you're saying?
Absolutely. From all people, it seemed. Obviously, he was not perfect, but I think his compassion and his dedication to reach out and help those who need help. And that is lacking today.
Edith, thank you for calling. Jack Beatty, your thoughts on RFK 50 years later?
Well, Rick Kallenberg, a student of RFK, on our program this week, said that he stood for, quote, a liberalism without elitism and a populism without racism. That's finely said, and it does sum up at least my memory of RFK and also what our caller was raising. But there was another aspect to him, too, and that was his impolitic candor. He spoke directly and sometimes against the political advantage of the moment. In Indiana, talking to a businessman's luncheon, he said, you know, there are more rats than people in New York City. And the Rotarians laughed, and he shouted, don't laugh. Mm-hmm. Hard to imagine that happening today. At the Indiana University Medical School, he outlined an ambitious program of national health insurance, and a black janitor yelled out, we want Kennedy. One of the medical students says, no, we don't, and said, where are you going to get the money for this, Senator? And Senator Kennedy looked at him and pointed, and he said, from you to the medical student. That kind of courage doesn't exist anymore.
You know, Janet Hook, I was reminded in 2016, political reporters started finding a lot of voters, typically white working class voters, who were torn between two candidates, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. And it reminded me of 50 years ago, political reporters in Indiana watching the primary found white working class voters who were drawn to two Democratic contenders, Robert Kennedy and George Wallace. Somehow he could tap into the same appeal. Did you see any of that today?
Well, it was very interesting in the 2016 campaign, seeing the kind of common threads of frustration with the political system that you saw between Trump and Bernie Sanders supporters. When I think back to Robert Kennedy, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when he was assassinated, but young enough that I don't remember much about it. But I do have this feeling about this year. As you said, it was such a landmark year with so many terrible and tumultuous things happening, that this year we're just sort of marching from one 50th anniversary to another. And so when it was the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, 50 years, mm-hmm. there was the clip that was pulled from Robert Kennedy speaking in Indianapolis at the time.
He announced it to people.
He broke the news. Broke the news to mm-hmm. a crowd and encouraged them to not react with violence. And Indianapolis was one of the few major cities that didn't have major riots. So I don't know. That was a very tumultuous year. While I see the comparison you're making, I mostly see sort of vast differences between where we are today than the way we were then.
Well, thank you very much. Did I mention that the Washington Capitals won the Stanley Cup last night?
Go Caps.
Okay. Janet Hook, national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, it's great to talk with you again. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Robert.
And you all can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, Catherine Proctor, Jeremy Relosa, James Ross, Gretchen Voss, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Caroline Anders. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up on Monday, fallout from the G7 and the North Korean summit. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.